What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Martin Cooper. Martin is an engineer, inventor, entrepreneur, and futurist. He is known as the father of the cell phone. He led the creation of the world's first cell phone at Motorola and made the first public call on it. Over nearly three decades at Motorola, Cooper contributed to the development of pagers, two-way radio dispatch systems, quartz crystal manufacture, and more. A serial entrepreneur, he and his wife, Arlene Harris, have co-founded numerous wireless technology companies. This includes Cellular Business Systems, SOS Wireless Communications, Great Call, and more. Cooper is currently the chairman of Dyna LLC and a member of the FCC's Technological Advisory Council. He was the first to observe the law of spectrum capacity, which became later known as Cooper's Law. In 2013, Cooper became a member of the National Academy of Engineering, from whom he received the Charles Stark Draper Prize for Engineering. He was awarded the Marconi Prize for being a wireless visionary to reshape the concept of mobile communication. He has been inducted into Consumer Electronics Hall of Fame, as well as the Wireless History Foundation's Hall of Fame. The Radio Club of America awarded him a Lifetime Achievement Award in 2010. He is a lifetime member of the IEEE, was president of its Vehicular Technology Society, and received its Centennial Medal. In 2007, Time Magazine named him one of the 100 best inventors in history. And now I give you Martin Cooper. Okay, I'm here with Martin Cooper. Marty, thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here, Josh.
Thank you, sir. There's so much I want to discuss. I want to discuss obviously the cell phone and the part that you played in it. But before we get there, please tell our listeners that might not be familiar with you who you are and what you do.
Well, my name is Martin Cooper. Call me Marty. I'm a has-been engineer, although I still have lots of interest in technology. My passion at the moment is the digital divide in education and anything else that relates to technology and futurism. I was involved many years ago with the introduction of the first handheld cell phone, and I presently am serving on the FCC Technology Advisory Council and on other groups that are looking to improve the human experience.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you, sir. So winding the clock back then, Marty, what does the pre-mobile phone telecommunications landscape look like?
Well, it's my view that we are only in just the beginning of what has been a revolution. The cell phone, as you know, became commercial. The handheld cell phone, the modern handheld cell phone, it became commercial in 1983. It didn't really become widely used until the beginning of this century. And the concept of the smartphone is really only about 10 years old. So we're still in early days. I'm not very happy about the nature of what the modern cell phone is. But, you know, you look at a modern cell phone and wet plastic and put it against this round head of yours and hold your arm in an awkward position, which none of which makes any sense. It's not optimized for any of its applications. The cell phone manufacturers tell us, oh, that you can optimize your phone for you. You can personalize it. All you have to do is select among 2 or 3 million apps and pick out the one that's right for you. And that doesn't make any sense at all. So I think we are in early stages. That at some point your cell phone will contain an artificial intelligence. It's already an extension of the person.
Yes.
In many ways. But in the future, you'll have an artificial intelligence that will analyze your habits and create a cell phone that is you. It'll be Josh's phone and not some engineer's idea of what your phone should be. And as the cell phone evolves, it will really become an extension of your personality, and it will increase your ability to hear, see, remember, because these devices can do all these things better than we can do naturally. And the one thing the phone can't do is be creative and actually implement things. So I think society would be much better off. There are people that don't like some of the side effects of cell phones, but we'll figure it out.
Yes, without question, Marty. No, thank you very much. So it was in the early 1970s, if my notes were correct here, you headed Motorola's communications systems division. And as you gleaned at, you conceived the first portable cellular phone in 1973. And that was at the end of that then led to a 10-year process of actually bringing it to market. So take all the time you need with this one, Marty. I don't mind getting into the weeds here, but I would love to know, what was the experience of running that project like?
Well, first of all, the idea of a handheld device that hooks you up to other people started out with two-way radios. People don't know much about two-way radios, and you know that the police organize themselves with two-way radios. Most of the businesses in the world that have assets that move around cannot manage without personal communications. And the very first people that got involved with personal communications that had to be managed with software were, believe it or not, concrete mixing trucks. Here you have mobile assets that are moving around. They're very time sensitive. You have a truck that gets stuck somewhere or doesn't know where to go, and that concrete hardens in the truck. And you have a huge expense of either throwing away the drum on this truck or people in a truck with jackhammers. So we knew that personal communications was going to be important. And then along comes the Bell system. You're too young to remember the Bell system, Josh, but this was a monopoly that ran all telephones in the country. If you wanted to have telephone service, you had to rent your telephone. And all the telephones were black, and they were all identical. So they were a monopoly. They not only offered the service, but they did the development at a place called Bell Laboratories. They manufactured their own equipment at an outfit called Western Electric. So it was a fully integrated monopoly. And they announced to the world that they had a new concept called cellular telephony. They were going to provide a service where you could talk from anywhere wirelessly. And we were astounded to discover this. It was going to be car telephones. Well, we already knew that what people wanted was the ability to be anywhere, anytime. And you think about how much time you spend in your car. It's a tiny fraction of what your total life is like. And so our first reaction to that was we were incredulous that an outfit that had Bell Laboratories that ostensibly had the most advanced technological capability in the world were announcing something that we're going to constrain you to your cars. For 100 years, we had been constrained by the pair of wires coming into our house, and now we're going to be stuck in our cars, which is not much of an improvement. So that was the first thing that troubled us. The second was is that the view of the Bell system was this is not going to be a very big business. And so there was no point in having anybody else offer it. They wanted a monopoly, would you believe? And of course, once you have a monopoly like this, they're saying, well, we should be able to do anything with our monopoly. And there was a potential of them putting us out of business. Here we have the biggest company in the world by every measure, the most revenues, the most profits, the most number, greatest number of people. They were properly a contender. So that didn't make any sense to us. And that's when we took the Bell system on. And we went to the FCC and said, first of all, the Bell system is not the only one technically capable of doing this. We know how to do portable communications. We've been doing it for years. The second thing is we think it's going to be a huge market, and it ought to be competitive, just like most businesses are. There's absolutely no reason to have a monopoly. And the third thing we said is that the most advanced technology should be used. And we now have the ability to do personal communications. So the device should be a handheld device, and you should be able to communicate any place, anywhere around. And that process started in 1969, and the commercial service didn't actually start until 1983. So what happened during that 14-year period is that there were deliberations on, first of all, who should offer the service? Should it be competitive? Should it be the industry select, whether it's portables or car telephones, what the role of the FCC is? Many decisions had to be made, and things didn't happen very fast in the old days. I'm not sure they're happening much faster today, but it did take a long time to resolve all these things. But in 1973, actually 1972, we at Motorola became paranoid about whether the FCC was going to win this battle or not. And so we proposed to do a really aggressive approach to the politicians in Washington, to the press in New York, and persuade them of what the facts were, that the world didn't need another monopoly, and that the world was ready for handheld portable phones. It was at that point that I decided that the only way we were going to get people's attention is to actually demonstrate a working handheld phone. And that's when I put a team together and we actually created such a phone. The idea came in November of 1972. By the beginning of 1973, we had the team put together, the management supporting us, and we really had to reach out for experts throughout our company to come up with the latest semiconductors. We were using a frequency band that had never been used before, 1,000 megahertz, 900 megahertz, and all kinds of new technology. And in 3 months, this team put together a working handheld portable telephone. It was, by today's standards, huge, but you could hold it in your hand. The battery life was only 25 minutes of talking, but that was not a problem because the phone was so heavy and it weighed a couple of pounds. You couldn't hold it up for more than but whatever it is, the demonstrations were successful, and it took another 10 years to solve a few other problems. First of all, the technical problems, all these breakthroughs took to make the first phone, and that first phone had, in order to keep it running, we actually had two phones. In case one broke, we had an engineer standing by with another one, because these things were handheld and individually manufactured. It took 10 years to create all the technology. The second thing that had to happen is the FCC had to decide who was going to offer the service. It was not going to be a monopoly. And then who should do that? And the thing that created that opportunity was the Bell system was split up into a bunch of operating companies. And so ultimately the FCC decision was, we will split this band of frequencies up into two parts. One will be operated by the residue of the Bell system, and that is these operating companies, and the other it will be independent operators. And that is the genesis of how our present system was created. As you know, there were a whole bunch of independent operators, but little by little, they consolidated. And at the moment, we have three major operators, and there are still a number of smaller operators throughout the country. But at the moment, it's AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile. I think that's a big mistake. I think we ought to have more competition, more people working to fulfill different markets rather than these guys competing with each other. Each one of them looks very much like the original Bell system. That's not what we had in mind. If you think about the competitive world, it's like the competitive world would look for a group of customers that they can serve better than other people. And we are little by little moving in that direction. T-Mobile does offer services that the other carriers don't. As I said before, we're still in early stages in the cellular telephony business.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you, Marty. One thing I'm always curious to talk about is challenges. And I'm curious if there are any major challenges that came up for you and your team during this project.
Well, the technical challenges were extraordinary. First of all, the frequency band that the FCC had made available for cellular telephony, it was at 900 megahertz. I don't know if your audience is aware of what the different frequency bands are, but at that point, the highest frequency we had ever used was 450 megahertz, and going up to 900 megahertz was a major challenge. Now, there had been no communications at that frequency before. And because of that, we now have to come up with a whole new technology of transmitting, receiving, new antennas. And furthermore, we had never operated what's called duplex mode. Look at how police radios work. They are pressed to talk. When you wanted to talk, you push a button, and then you let the button go, and you could listen. Well, that's just not suitable for consumers. Consumers want to be able to interrupt other people and to hold conversations just as you and I are talking now.
Yes, sir.
So we had to do a thing called duplex. And we had done duplex before in car telephones, but the duplex device was bigger than your fist. It was bigger than the entire modern cell phone. So that was a major challenge. And then, of course, we had never, ever operated with more than a few channels. A typical police radio will have three or four, maybe even a half a dozen channels. A cellular telephony requires many hundreds of channels. So now we had to use large-scale integrated circuits, which had never been developed before. So the number of challenges we had were just extraordinary, and it just gives you an idea of how sharp this team was to have put together these things in a matter of 3 months or so.
Yeah, that is incredible. Were there ever any doubts as to the project being completed?
Of course there were doubts. There were doubts. You know, people ask me, how did I feel with this historical moment of standing on the streets of New York and doing the first public demonstration of a phone? Did I have a feeling of the historical significance of that moment? I say, well, not exactly. And the only thing I was worried about, will this thing work? And of course, there was a guy standing off to the side with a spare phone just in case something broke. The night before, we were in a suite at the Hilton Hotel and still fixing things in this portable phone that were breaking because, as I mentioned before, it was a handheld device. Every solder joint was hand soldered. And the reliability was not what you would call acceptable by today's standards.
That's incredible. So the day before, that was actually going to be my next question, was regarding this. For our audience, it was in 1973, Marty, you became the first person in history to make a handheld cellular phone call in public. And it's fascinating to me that the day before this, as you mentioned, historic event, you're fixing things right up until the moment when you have to do it. That's fascinating to me.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Well, the other kind of unique thing was the real launch of this phone happened after that phone call that I just described. And we did a press conference at the Hilton, and they were nice enough. We told them we had a team of people that are going to be working on this. They let us have the penthouse suite at the Hilton. And this is a suite that was famous because Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor had used this suite whenever they were in New York. So here we were in this magnificent two-story suite on top of the Hilton Hotel with a guy working with a sounder gear fixing our portable phone. So this is how technology gets born.
That's incredible. Just blood, sweat, and tears. So on the actual phone call itself, once again, in 1973, where were you and what was the experience like? If my information was correct, you were phoning an old rival. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. Our original intent was to be on a TV program that morning on April 3rd, 1973. There was a TV morning show, and as luck would have it, we got bumped at the last minute. There was something more important. And if you think about it, there wasn't the portable phone was not very important at that time. Nobody even knew what that was.
Sure.
And they found a little radio station that would offer to interview me. And I told them, well, if we're going to do an interview and demonstrate a portable cell phone, we ought to do it out of the street. And so I met the reporter in front of the Hilton and told them what we were talking about and how I could call anybody in the world from standing on the streets of New York. And, of course, I had to demonstrate it. And I have to tell you, Josh, it was a spur-of-the-moment idea. I thought, you know, I'm going to call my counterpart in the Bell system. You might say that he was the enemy, but Bell system, Bell Laboratories, was a highly respected organization. So I reached in my pocket to pull out my phone book. If that doesn't give you an idea of what ancient history this was, I had a little printed phone book. And I called Joel Engel in the Bell system. And as luck would have it, he answered the phone himself, not his assistant. And I said, hi, Joel. This is Marty Cooper. He said, hi, Marty. I said, Joel, I'm calling you from a cell phone, but a real cell phone, a personal, handheld, portable cell phone. You could see I wasn't bashful about rubbing it in. And Joel was polite to me. To this day, he does not remember that phone call. I don't blame him. It really did happen.
Extraordinary. How'd you feel after the call? Celebratory?
Yeah, exactly. We were very happy that it worked. We were especially happy about my serendipitous selection of who was going to be the first recipient of a phone call. Joel's not very happy about it, but we were. So, but of course, that was just the beginning. All we had done is made one phone call. That afternoon, we did a press conference, and we had a lady at the press conference say, well, if this phone is so great, can I call my mother in Australia? And we said, of course you can. And I asked her for her number. I dialed a number, and would you believe it? It was a wrong number. But on the second try, we woke her mother up in Australia, and she was astounded. The thing that non-technical people would not have understood is that this the portable part of this, the wireless part of this phone call, was across the street to our base station. So we were only talking like a half a block wirelessly, and the rest of it was going through the wired system to Australia. But that's exactly how cell phones work today. So that phone call was successful. The press conference was successful. We moved on after New York, now that we have proved that this thing could work. And we set up a system in Washington. And the intent there was to talk to the congressmen, senators, and the Federal Communications Commission and show them that this thing was real. It wasn't just an engineer's dream, and persuade them that the service, first of all, should not be a monopoly, and that the industry should use whatever technology was the most modern technology. So we actually spent days in Washington demonstrating this portable phone over and over again, and we did that driving through Washington. You should know, however, that we selected the route very carefully because it didn't work everywhere. So we took these congressmen, senators, FCC commissioners on a car ride, but we knew exactly where we were going to be at every moment, and the phone worked everywhere.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible, Marty. Thank you so much for sharing that. I hate to ask a sort of nebulous question, but I feel somewhat obliged to. After the mobile phone comes out, were you aware, did you have any inkling as to how that invention would change the world?
Well, the answer is yes and no. First of all, we were certain that this was going to be a huge business. We totally disagreed with the Bell system. The Bell system hired a high-powered pollster, and their conclusion was that the maximum number of phones, of handheld phones, whatever exists in the world, was 1 million for the entire world. And interestingly enough, they were right. The maximum number of car telephones that ever existed in the world was roughly 1 million. We were convinced that this was going to be an everyday thing, that the wired phones didn't make any sense at all if you had the capability of doing it wirelessly, the freedom to be anywhere. So we had a story that we would tell people that someday when you were born, you would be assigned a phone number. And if you didn't answer the phone, you had died. So, and think about it. Today, there are more cell phones in the world than there are people. There are more cell phones in the United States than there are people. There are 6 times more cell phones than there are wired phones in the United States today, and the number of wired phones is going down. So we had an inkling of what was going to happen. The thing that we did not know was, first of all, this was ancient history, 1973. There were no digital cameras, and there were no large-scale integrated circuits, no personal computers, and no digital cameras. So the idea that all of those things would be incorporated into something you could hold in your hand, it was even beyond our imaginations. So things have changed a great deal since 1973. Indeed. And as I said before, we're only at the beginning. What we call the cell phone today is going to introduce a number of revolutions in the future. And we're only at the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious if you sort of gleaned at it at the beginning of our chat here, Marty, but is the technology that you created being used in the way you had hoped it would be when you first invented it?
Well, our motivation at that time, the nature of what our business was to improve productivity. You know, I mentioned this, the concrete mixing things. We made that business more successful. We made the police departments more effective. We made other business more productive. So efficiency was our intent. And if you think about it, that's the most important thing cell phones do today. Cell phones provide the lubrication for our system. They make your life safer, more convenient, and more productive. Are there bad side effects? Well, there are. I was interviewed by BBC last week, and this lady in London mentioned to me that she's on her cell phone. They call it a mobile phone across the ocean. She's on her mobile phone 5 hours a day. Oh. And my reaction to that was, get a life. Would you believe, I've been on at least 150 podcasts over the past year and a half since I've published my book, which I know you're going to mention at some point. And I got more attention to that one comment than all of my other interviews put together. But so I'm not crazy about going into a restaurant and seeing people sit around the table and they're all looking at their cell phones. But sooner or later, as I said before, cell phones still new. People are just getting used to it, and we're going to get over it. Personal interaction is still very important. It's crucial, and people are not going to spend 5 hours a day on their cell phones, but they will benefit from those phones 24/7.
Excellent. Excellent. Yes, and I do have some time set aside toward the end to discuss your book, sir. Wouldn't dream of having you on and not talking about it. One thing that is kind of funny, Marty, as I was preparing for this interview, I was thinking to myself, you know, I'm going to be the first person to interview Marty Cooper and not ask him what kind of cell phone he has. You can't make me. I'm going to be the first person to do it. And I gave my audience a little poll about what questions I might ask you. And every single one of them, a great majority of them wanted me to ask you what kind of cell phone you had. And then I thought, damn, I have to do it.
I apologize for that, Josh, because everybody does ask me that. And since I know you're going to ask that, I have to be ready for it. And so I always have, I try every new cell phone that is on the market. It's become very hard to discriminate between the different phones because everybody copies everybody else.
Right.
I mostly now use an iPhone. And the reason I mostly use that is that it's integrated with my watch, which is an iWatch. And it has all kinds of features that I like. Even as an example, when I swim laps, which I do for exercise, this thing not only counts my laps, but it also knows what stroke I'm doing. Mm. Is that amazing or what? Yeah. But I also have a Samsung folding phone because I had to really understand whether that technology is useful. And by the way, it's marginally useful. It's an amazing technology, but technology, in my view, is meaningless unless it makes the human experience better. If it doesn't make your life better, a person's life better, it's not very good technology. And at the moment, the folding phone, that doesn't do very much for me, but I'm sure that the applications will arise that will make it useful for some group of people in our population.
Agreed. Yep. And indeed, in setting up this interview, I used my Galaxy S9, it is. So I'm an Android man myself. So yes, Marty, I do actually want to discuss the book, Cutting the Cord. What prompted you to write it?
Well, I had three missions. One is I wanted people to understand that inventions don't happen spontaneously. You know, there is an image people have of a light bulb flashing in their head and the idea pops up. And really, you have to build up experiences, first of all, with people, if you're going to understand what the needs of people are and with the technologies that fulfill those needs. And so I had a number of inventions before the cell phone, and it took years and years to build up the confidence and the understanding of what the problem was before I could even do something like that. Mm. And the second thing is you also have to build up the reputation so you get support from people like the Motorola management. Joining Motorola, which I did in 1954, it was one of the smartest things I ever did in my life. At that time, I thought that my job lifetime would be a few years. And it turns out I was at Motorola for 30 years because they were just incredible organizations that taught me a great deal. So that was the first part of the book. And the second part is I wanted to talk about the cell phone because even in places like the United States, people don't realize what impact the cell phone has had on society worldwide. As an example, which I talk about in the book, that a billion people moved out of severe poverty in Africa largely because of the existence of a cell phone. And there are experiments going on in healthcare, where in Mexico, for example, putting a small, inexpensive device on a cell phone allows doctors in the smallest village in Mexico to, or people in the smallest villages, talking to a doctor in Mexico City analyzing an eye disease. Hmm. And the same thing is happening with the ultrasonic measurements of pregnant women, where the cell phone acts as the communications to doctors. And so people in these villages now have access to healthcare that they could never hope to have before. So I talk a lot about how the cell phone is being used in the world today. And the third thing that's covered in the book is what the future of the cell phone is, how there is the potential for future cell phones to be able to analyze your body on a continuing basis, to do a physical examination every minute or so, and zap diseases before they happen. Hmm. Just imagine, Josh, a world where there is no disease because you are being monitored for disease all the time, and the diseases are stopped before they happen. So, and the other one that I have a real passion for is how wireless connectivity is going to change education. Because our educational system today was created hundreds of years ago, and we still go through the same process. We divide education up into silos that have no significance in real life, you know, arithmetic, geography, history, and so forth.
Right.
And the educational system is still, in most places, hour-long lectures. And if there's one way not to educate people, it's to keep their attention, it's to lecture them for an hour. So the cell phone is now making it possible for a student to have access to all the knowledge in the world full-time, 24/7. And the sad thing about that, the good thing is the opportunity, because that learning experience is going to actually make these students smarter. It's hard to admit that the next generation is going to be smarter than you are, but that's inevitable. The bad thing is that at the moment, for one reason or another, half of our students don't have access to the equivalent of a cell phone, to wireless connectivity, either because there's no coverage where they are or because they can't afford it. And that's inexcusable. We cannot have a world with smart people who have access to the world's knowledge and the rest of them are dummies. So I am passionate about solving that problem. And I work with the government. As I mentioned before, I'm on the FCC Technological Advisory Council, and I'm trying to persuade people that this is an important public imperative. We have to learn how to educate everybody. And I want to add that the other overweening thing that people don't quite understand is the importance of collaboration, the importance of being able to have an idea, exchange ideas with somebody else instantaneously. Just think about it, about when Einstein came up with the theory of relativity, he'd have an idea, he would write the thing down, he would send a letter to Niels Bohr, which would take a week or two to get delivered. Bohr would think about it for a month or two, and then write a letter back to Einstein about his views, and think about the difference between that and a Zoom call today, call like you and I are having. I can see you. I can see your beautiful smile. And we can exchange ideas instantaneously. It is lubricating productivity, and it's ultimately going to not only eliminate disease, educate people, but it will eliminate poverty. That's, I think, the ultimate objective.
Excellent. Excellent. Where can people get the book, sir?
Oh, that's available on Amazon and your favorite bookstore, although you're going to have to twist the bookstore owner's arm. I really made a mistake, Josh, in trying to put too much in the book. Hmm. You would think that a guy with my experience would understand about marketing. But it's very hard to market something that doesn't have a specific objective. I should have written three books, but it took me about 8 years to do the this book. And I'm afraid I don't have another 16 years to go.
Yes. So, Marty, outside of the book, What are you working on currently, sir?
Well, as I mentioned, I'm passionate about this digital divide.
Yes.
And I believe that the technology exists so we could provide coverage everywhere in the country if people will identify this as an important thing to do. Mm-hmm. Our carriers like to emphasize the big cities because they have many more customers in the big cities. I think it's incumbent upon the FCC to require them to, or somebody to provide cellular service virtually everywhere in the country where there are people. The technology exists to do that. You've heard about 5G. Well, at the moment, the interpretation of the carriers of 5G is a thing called millimeter waves that lets you talk to people in the big city with the range of literally across the street. And that same technology could be used in farmlands of Indiana to talk 20 miles and cover enough people to allow an entrepreneur to provide service. And furthermore, I don't know if you've looked at your cell phone bill lately, but I bet you that you spend at least $50 a month, if not more than that.
Oh, yes, almost double.
And it is possible technologically to provide service for $5 a month. A student does not have to necessarily have to have 100% reliability. They don't need super bandwidth. They don't need super latency. Most people don't even know what latency is, and I'm not going to explain it now before people to death. And so there's no question that if our society puts their mind to it, they can provide 99% of the students of this country with full-time access to all the knowledge in the world.
Brilliant. Martin Cooper, how can people find out about you, sir?
Well, you go on YouTube and Wikipedia and any place else. The name of my book, by the way, is Cutting the Cord, How the Cell Phone Has Transformed Humanity. And it's my view that cell phone really has transformed humanity. It's made us more effective, reduced disease, reduced poverty, and improved health care. But it's not important that people find out about me. It's that they promote the future of the cell phone, that they people realize that we've got a long way to go. There is enormous potential for eliminating disease, for making people smarter, and for getting people to work together, and hopefully to mitigate this polarization that is a cancer on our society.
Excellent. And I'll be sure I include a link to the book in my show notes, Marty. My pleasure. Marty, thank you so much for the time. Say, this was a real pleasure. And if I may say, in honor as well, thank you so much.
It was my honor, Josh. And thank you for the great questions and your beautiful smile.
I'll keep brushing my teeth. Seems like it's working.
Good luck, Josh.
Thank you, Marty. Take care, sir.
Bye-bye now.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.